Let's think this morning about something called unconditional love. Love with no strings attached. Love that wants you to do well and be healthy, but keeps on loving you even if you are down and out. There isn't as much of that kind of love as you might think. I wouldn't have known what to call it when I was a child, but I realized even then that my mother certainly had it. She wanted me to behave and fulfill whatever potential her charitable eyes saw in me, but I was absolutely convinced that no matter how poorly I fulfilled her hopes, she would love me anyway. Love me even if I fell so far as to say I no longer loved her. My dad may have had almost as much unconditional love as she did, although I sometimes thought that if I ever got bad enough, he might just finally throw in the towel. But not so for my mother. I grew up firmly convinced that there was no way I could forfeit her love, that I could break her heart by being careless, but that there was no way I could ever stop her from loving me. We don't talk about it much, but most love is quid pro quo. You love me, and I love you. But if one of us stops, that's the end of it. We expect people to love us when we are charming and kind and generous. What is incredible and extremely rare is to have someone who still loves us when we are none of those things, who may not like us because like and love are not the same, but who still love us. Love, after all, is far more demanding than liking because it goes beyond feelings and emotions into a commitment to treat another person right, even if we have to grit our teeth in private to do it. Unconditional love took hold of my thoughts last week and wouldn't turn loose because of a letter I received. One thing, by the way, which keeps preaching from ever becoming routine is that sermons grow in such odd ways. Seeds are planted by a note or a passing remark, or a scene in a film, or a line in a book. And for a week, or a month, or a year, they germinate until the pressure to see the light is finally great enough that a sermon pops up. Before the letter came last week, one of the seeds for this sermon was planted months ago in a phone call from my son in Oklahoma, who told me that just before Christmas, he spoke a prayer to his church in which he mentioned his annual wish list for the world. In it, along with a lot of other wishes for food in Africa and peace in Yugoslavia and a stable economy for Russia, there was this sentence: I wish for someone to find a cure for AIDS. Now, that may sound innocuous enough to all of you, but it fell on one set of ears in that congregation like an angry clap of thunder. The ears belonged to an older man who didn't like the young minister much in the first place, because he had a beard and he was a little too sure of himself and had not liked Mr. Reagan and Mr. Bush enough. But more than that, This older man hated hearing people spoken of lovingly, whose sexual preferences filled him with fear and a puzzling sort of uneasiness. So he brooded about that particular item in the young minister's prayer. I wish for someone to find a cure for AIDS. Brooded until he came back to church a few days later to celebrate Christmas Eve with an angry note stuck in his pocket. It will seem unbelievable to you that a man would bother to show up to celebrate the birth of the Holy Child with a heart as full of hatred as his, but out of habit or something, he came. My son passes out candles to be carried in procession on that night. And as he approached the man I've been talking about, the man's wife was overheard to say, "No, no, Bill, please. Don't give the note to Robin right now. This is not a good time." And Bill was overheard to reply, "Hey, I just want Robin to know that people also die of heart attacks in this country. Good people. And why isn't he talking about them?" Now, you know, of course, what his real problem was. And it had nothing to do with coronary disease. Can you imagine what solace and comfort that man might give as a professing Christian to certain people dying of AIDS? His love has strings attached. Meet his criteria, and he may wish you well. Fail them, and you can die alone and loveless, as far as he's concerned. His face, I've seen it, has shaped itself into an image of the hatred he harbors, eyes narrowed with suspicion, lips tight, jaw set hard. Not surprising that he would be mad on Christmas Eve because his minister wanted the church to care about dying people, some of whom had been careless, some of whom had been weak, some of whom had sought love in accord with the hand life dealt them, as we all do, and some of whom, men, women, and children, unsuspectingly got the wrong pint of blood in a hospital, but all equally sick and afraid and desperately in need of comfort. Then there was the letter, which came a few days ago, from a young man you do not know and who does not worship here or in any other church on Sundays for reasons you will discover. I saw this young man occasionally when he was a child, and I really do not know him well, which makes his opening up his heart to me all the more poignant. He begins, "Dear Dr. Myers, I am wanting to tell you something that is affecting me and my family. It is very difficult news for me to tell people, but I have decided it's best to be open and honest with family and friends. First of all, I consider you family. I always have and always will. You are a very special person in my life, even though we see each other maybe once a year. I've not been very church-going since I was 17 or so, mainly because I felt I didn't fit in. Now I feel very much alone because in January I was diagnosed as having AIDS." He speaks of knowing that he was different from most of his friends as far back as elementary school. but of keeping his difference a secret as much as possible. Now he says, he is telling those who didn't know about his present health, including even some family, so, as he says, they can start their grieving process. He says that he still feels pretty well despite alarming blood counts, that he thinks a positive attitude can help him, and that he is not yet ready to leave this life, but he also says that he knows that will come sooner for him than for others. And then this boy, whom I do not know very well, wrote the paragraph that I will not be able to forget. I would also like to take this time to ask you to officiate at my memorial service, whenever that might be. I have always held you dear in my heart. I would very much like to have you do it. I have written to tell him that I will do that if I must, but to live in hope, remembering how suddenly medical breakthroughs can happen and how many brilliant and dedicated people are working to save his life. I couldn't help wondering how the man in my son's church would feel to get that letter from a boy who says at the bottom, P.S., on June the 9th, I will be 26. How do we feel? What do we do? What is the response of this thing called unconditional love, that commodity the church is supposed to have in special abundance? Mother Teresa is able to say important things in very few words. And she said once about her ministry, I do what I can where I am with what I have. Each time I hear that or read it, I become more and more convinced that it would be hard to find a better daily guide. I do what I can where I am with what I have. About AIDS, Mother Teresa thinks God is speaking to us through this disease. Mother Teresa, of course, thinks God speaks to us through everything that happens, good or bad. But she often wisely leaves it up to us to decide what God may be saying. I can only answer for myself, but one thing I don't think God is saying is that AIDS is some kind of divine judgment on homosexuality. I do not believe that homosexuality is a deliberate choice any more than my heterosexuality was. But even if it were, the thought that God intervenes to punish someone by giving that person a deadly disease which God knows in advance will spread to infect the innocent is a distortion of religion I cannot accept. I do understand why we are so frightened. We're used to illnesses that can be cured, and the word incurable terrifies us. But beyond that, this disease brings together blatantly all those issues we have such a hard time with: intimacy, vulnerability, love different from our own, the mystery and power of sexuality itself, death. No wonder we fall silent, retreat into polite nervousness and bad jokes. The very best I could hope from the man in Oklahoma City is that he might sometimes say to himself, well, maybe our sexual preferences are not learned, but simply part of us from the beginning, but what he says to himself most of the time is, but what about promiscuity? How can we have sympathy for anyone who gets AIDS from sex? Even if some of those people, as he would put it, truly love one another. And one wants to ask him, have you ever seen or heard of lust and promiscuity among heterosexuals? Do you know how many sexually transmitted diseases have ravaged populations, including innocent children, because heterosexuals lust and love? But he would not want to hear that because he is so frightened and full of anger. He will not welcome logic. The boy who wrote the letter to me knew that he was gay by the time of junior high school. Now he has AIDS. Ryan White was an Indiana boy who got the same disease from a blood transfusion. Timothy is a 2-year-old in New York City who has AIDS because his mother used a tainted needle. A man you know in Wichita, highly respected, got carelessly intoxicated one night in New York City, sought comfort foolishly in the arms of a prostitute, and came to me scared out of his wits that he might have contracted AIDS. He hadn't, so for some reason he escaped God's punishment for drunkenness, lust, and carelessness. Right? You know, we can't work out a system for knowing why some suffer and others don't. And it isn't our business anyway. We are in the business of offering unconditional love. I missed my chance to see the quilt. I'm told that if you see it, it isn't necessary to hear a sermon like this. One boy represented in that quilt confessed down in Florida, where he lived and died, that his greatest fear on learning he had AIDS was that he would lose his church when he needed it most. I would leave a church instantly that would refuse to comfort a person dying of AIDS, no matter how he or she got it. There are no strings attached to these sentences. I was sick, and you visited me. Do unto others as you would want them to do for you. Consider others better than yourselves. Carry each other's burdens. Pray for each other that you may be healed. If we are going to wave Bibles in hundreds and thousands of churches in this country and bang them on pulpits, for God's sake, let's listen to what those Bibles say. One more true story about a mother. The mother, as it happens, of a seminary professor from Minnesota. Her son, a professor of Christian ethics, had many discussions with her about loving people in spite of, rather than because of, what they might be or what we might think of what they are. She had accepted all this in her head, but deep down, she was greatly troubled by the fact that two of her son's student friends were gay and dying of AIDS. One night her son told her that the two friends were coming over to say goodbye to him. Over here? Yes, over here, he said. How else could they say goodbye? When the knock came at the door, the woman asked her son to let them in. They were both very thin, and one had the disfiguring lesions of Kaposi's sarcoma all over his neck and face and arms. She crossed the room to say hello, and when they introduced themselves and gave their names, Jack and Roger, she quite surprised herself by embracing them. Jack carried a pan of brownies in one arm. He was always cooking, and he put them down on the table, explaining that they were a gift to both of them for all the kindness they had shown. After 2 or 3 hours of conversation, they left, and this woman was left alone with her son in the quiet of the house. "I liked your friends very much," she said. "Were they good students?" "Very good," the professor said. "There is a terrible sadness over me," his mother went on, "and it must be worse for you. What shall we do? What can we do?" And then after a long silence, she said, "Pass me that pan of brownies. I think I'll have one." They washed them down with milk and tears, speaking not another word. The professor said in our meeting, "When I told this story to a certain young woman, she said, 'Boy, I'd never do that.' 'Do what?' I said. 'Eat those brownies.' I said, 'Is that what you got out of the story?' 'Well,' she said, 'I suppose you meant that it was real sweet of her to do that.' 'Not sweet,' I said. 'More like fearless. All that pain and fear, and when she got past herself and made the pain her own, she was reconciled.' 'Oh,' the young woman replied, 'so what do you call that? Is there a name for that?' 'I don't know what to call it myself,' I told her, 'but I know what the church calls it.' 'Yeah? What's that?' 'We call it communion.'